Welcome once again to this edition of Survival Sunday on the Dirt Walker Outdoors podcast, where I talk with prominent survival instructors and those who practice survival. Today's episode is an interview with Witch Dr. Joe Nichter, whose only claim to survivalism is not completing a 21-day challenge on the popular show Naked and Afraid. Joe is and has been an avid outdoorsman and primitive skills student from a young age, and practices these skills often as a means of spiritual healing. His insight into that is worth listening to. For the 38 some odd minutes of this podcast episode, Joe tells us, of course, about his experience with Naked and Afraid, but also how he came by and learned his skill. He also explains the realities of PTSD in a very clear manner that I find enlightening. Hello, Joe, and welcome to the Dirt Walker Outdoors podcast, Survival Sunday segment. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I chose you because not only did you appear on the Naked and Afraid episode, was that season 13, episode 9? Or I probably have that wrong.
Season 12, episode 9.
Season 12, episode 9, just for anyone who wants to look at it. I chose you because you had a very positive attitude afterwards, and your explanations, and you were very positive about your experience with the Discovery Channel, and you had a, I hate to use the word positive for the third time, positive outlook to share, and I was intrigued by that. So what began your path in life in survival? And I know you're going to say you didn't pursue being a survivalist, but tell us about how you came to the point to where Naked and Afraid became an opportunity.
Okay. Like all good stories, it started with I had too much to drink. I grew up with a natural love for primitive living skills. Grew up in the country. I had 500 acres behind my house, and I was encouraged very strongly to go outside and play. Grew up in the woods and camping with dad and hunting and fishing trips. The military was great because going to the field was like getting paid to do the stuff I used to do it for fun at home. And then I run a care home for the last 16 years and live at work. Most people get to drive home after a long day, and I just go in the other room. So I live at work for the last 16 years. So any opportunity I have to get out of here and do a little self-care, I take it. And I live right outside the Sequoia National Forest. So I spend a lot of time recharging and replenishing myself just by going up and spending a couple of days up in the woods camping. Although, I wouldn't say that I really pursued any of this in the idea of trying to be a survivalist. As far as the show goes, had a drink and was watching the show and saw something that was bugging me, like, why didn't he eat the howler monkey? Or how come he only set one trap? Or, you know, how we all armchair the show. And so I posted on social media, for the love of God, what do I have to do to get on the show and show you how it's done? And they text me back. And I tagged the show, Naked and Afraid. And then they sent me a message back and were like, hey, we saw your profile. Give us a call or fill out this application. And I was like, oh, wow, I got called out. So that's how I actually ended up getting on the show, was I was drunk texting them. As far as everything that led up to that, like I said, my dad would get out the last day of school. We'd pack up and go camping, and he'd bring me back home maybe a day or two before school was going to start again. I spent a whole summer vacation just surviving out in the woods. You take some provisions and you supplement that with whatever you can catch. Back then, it was fieldcraft for camping. It wasn't what we know as like bushcraft today. And most of the skills that I've learned that are now synonymous with bushcraft, something like bow drill. I used to be very active in the Native American sweat lodge ceremony that was local to a place I used to live. And they don't use a Zippo to start the sacred fire for this special ceremony. They use a bow drill. And the bow is actually a buffalo rib. There's a special ceremony for getting this fire going with this bow drill. And it was indigenous skills under the context that I learned it for this ceremony. Or something like cordage was something I learned when I was in AmeriCorps, which is a domestic peace corps program. I was in the Great Northwest, and we were learning about the Chinook Indians and how they would braid stinging nettle cordage to make these giant nests to catch the salmon. And we literally got a crash course class in how to make cordage out of stinging nettle. And that just opened the door to go, oh, can I do that with this plant? Can I do that with this plant? And so most of the skills that I've learned I didn't learn them in the context of I want to be a good bushcrafter. I just kind of Forrest Gumped my way through life and picked up these random sets of skills and knowledge that all of those things happen to be popular in the world of bushcraft. And so me getting out of my gilded cage to go do some self-care is I'm going to go up with a canteen cup and my knife and see if I can get a fire going, boil some water and make some instant coffee and get my cigar lit. That's self-care for me. Let me go see if I can just randomly go do that without a lighter, just because it's fun for me. It gives me something hard to do, something difficult to do to get out of the comfortable life that I live.
That's fascinating. It's a very good explanation of how you came to the show, although I love the drunk texting. a lot of things in life have obviously happened because of drunk texting. And you also learned some new things about survival and yourself during the 21 days or even more than that of the show. And in particular was one we've just talked about, the footprint that you made in your environment that too many people don't consider while you're in a survival situation or if you're hunting or whatever it is you're doing. You have to be mindful immediately of your footprint on what's around you.
That was something that it was kind of an aha moment. My little get away from here, my little recreational survival camping things are limited to maybe 3 days at the most, 4 days. If I'm lucky that I can go up there in the sequoias and go run around and, you know, play Tarzan for maybe 4 days before I have to get home. It's a very short time frame. There was things that I learned and discovered and noticed on the challenges. Like people talk about, oh, the carbon footprint that we're leaving on the planet. If you're not a hunter and you watch the different survival shows like Naked and Afraid, like somebody like Matt Wright, who's an amazing big game hunter, I learned a lot about hunting just from watching him on the show because he kind of narrates what he's doing and why he's doing it. We all know how they use ash and they use all these different things to camouflage their body, but also the masks they're sent. You don't want to be up or down wind, like all these things come into play just for hunting a deer or a gazelle or what have you. On my challenge, we did the insertion, and the very next morning, I slept pretty well. My partner did not. The next morning, we were up before sunrise, and it was light enough. There was ambient light, but not direct sunlight. My point is, I was surprised by how sparse the desert was during the insertion and how much animal activity there was that very first morning. I saw a lot of quail on the quail run that went right through our camp area. I saw rabbit. There was a lot of bird activity. There was a lot of javelina. There was a lot of pig activity that first night. But then the next day, there was less than half of the activity the next day. And every day that I was there, there was less and less activity. So I was there 11 days. So I would say by day 7, I wasn't seeing, there was no quail. There was no rabbit. There was no activity except for maybe the mountain lion that was trying to eat me at night and some of the transient birds that are just flying through the desert looking for food. But the animals that live in the area, I'm lazy. I'm not going to walk any farther than I need to relieve myself. So, you know, there's my urine smell, me going the same path to get water, me walking my trap line. And if I had more than one trap, they didn't show that on the edit. One of the things I always complained about is like, why did they only make the one trap? I made a trap line and they only showed my one trap. My point is the more you're active and the longer that you're active in an area, the deeper and the wider your footprint is, the evidence of your presence. In the military, they would call that a target indicator. Like if you're looking for bad guys and you see a broken branch or you see a footprint of a boot print in the mud, that's a target indicator, which means that there's enemy in the area kind of thing, that kind of mentality. In the animal kingdom, my urine is a target indicator. My footprint, my strong scent in the area where I've been sleeping for 3 or 4 days is a threat indicator. And so the longer that I was in that camp, the larger that indication was. There was my partner for a brief moment, but then there was also a film crew. And so you have these people that are following you around the whole time. It wasn't just my presence. It was the presence of, you know, the sound guy and the camera guy and the people that were following around and filming me in this scenario. And I did notice that, and I haven't had the opportunity to try it out, but my next adventure I want to do is I want to do that. I want to go for 3 or 4, maybe even 5 days, but I want to move my camps continually. I really think that if I set up a camp, that next morning is a really good window because, you know, most of your small game isn't really going to be fully aware that you're there. By the end of the day or the next day, they would be, or they will be, like they were for me on my challenge. So if I was to move camp every afternoon, the next morning is a golden opportunity because they don't really realize that I'm there yet. And my footprint isn't very loud or very deep or very profound. So my presence isn't as obvious as it would be after a couple of days. That was something that I learned, and I can't wait to put that to the test.
And you weren't joking about the mountain lion. That was actually a concern of yours from onset, day one.
Yes, day one. I never saw the mountain lion. I saw the evidence of the mountain lion. So during the insertion, I saw predator scat. I didn't point it out to my partner. Basically, I didn't want to scare her off. Like, I hadn't really got a good sense if that was something that she was going to be okay with or not. So I didn't want to scare her off. So I kept my mouth shut. We were like, I'm not sure what that noise is. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's a javelina getting eaten by a puma. But I'm not going to tell her that. So I'm like, oh, I think those javelinas got in a fight. But there was plenty of predator scat. There was plenty of puma poop. There was plenty of track. I was always trying to get an eye reflection off the personal cam that they give you. Like I said, I never saw one. I see the tracks. You could hear it eating other animals while they were still alive. There's one scene where I'm waving a billhook and screaming in Old Norse. And that was because I was laying down and I could hear the pads hitting the ground. I would guess maybe somewhere between 6 to 10 feet away from me. I could hear the brush move, like when somebody walks through the brush, high brush, not low brush. And so it was one of those, I can hear the brush moving. I could feel the footprint hitting, but you're not hearing, it's not a hoof print. And so you can hear the pads. Something is out there. My hearing is shot, which is another thing I didn't want to. You never want to tell anybody what your weakness is. Mine is that my hearing is really horrible. You could feel the vibration. You can sense there's something out there. You can hear the bigger, louder noise. And it wasn't until after the extraction and we're back at the ranch in recovery and they're like, here, eat this and here's some pickles. Oh, by the way, you want to see a picture of the mountain lion? I was like, yeah, I do. And so they showed me the footage of the mountain lion that was stalking us the entire time. And me by myself. And then when I moved and I was with my partner, there was mountain lions, there was coyotes, there was a bunch of stuff in the darkness. Those things were really out there. They filmed those things on site. Kind of felt silly, like I'm screaming out here. I'm probably screaming at some little puma pig that doesn't mean me any harm. But no, there is a pretty good-sized mountain lion out there.
And you had good dreams later that night.
And I had good dreams later that night. That's true. Full disclosure, for anybody who hasn't heard any of my other interviews or whatever, one of the things that I found really interesting and rewarding about my experience on the show was, so backstory is that I served in the United States Army and I served in Iraq and I came home and was clinically diagnosed with PTSD. And for the first probably 6 or 7 years, I had really horrible nightmares all the time. I have all those symptoms, anxiety and hypervigilance and intrusive thoughts and stuff, which is really exhausting. And so you want to go to sleep. And then when you go to sleep, get a better view of all the horrible stuff. So after a couple of years of this, I don't understand how that part of my brain works. But basically, I think there's a part of my mind that was like, yeah, we're not going to watch this anymore. We're going to pull the plug. So I stopped dreaming completely for over 8 years. I just didn't dream. While I was on the show, it was after my first partner left. It was probably around day five or six-ish or seven. I started dreaming again. And that part of my brain kicked on. It was an interesting side effect of the challenge is that while I was on the challenge, all my PTSD symptoms went away. My anxiety went away. My intrusive thoughts went away. All the stuff that most people with PTSD suffer with on a daily basis, all that stuff was gone by day two completely. And before the end of the week, I had started dreaming again and I wasn't having nightmares. October was when we filmed my episode. My challenge was in October. And I've been dreaming ever since then. So we're going on almost a year. And I still haven't had nightmares and I'm still having good dreams. Some of the other symptoms, like some of the anxiety, some of the interest, some of that stuff came back. But I feel like it's not as bad as it was before the challenge. And then also I'm having, my dreams are good and I'm having dreams at all, much less good dreams. There's something about that experience that repaired or kicked on and did the whole Fonzie on the jukebox thing. And a different part of my brain started working, and it started working better than it was before the challenge. And that's something that I've been researching and struggling to understand. While I was on the plane flying home, I'm on my smartphone Googling stuff. Is this a thing that exists that I just didn't know about? I read a lot of books on things like that, trying to understand what happened. And I wasn't the only one. I'm not the only cast member who has had anxiety and different PTSD, traumatic issues. And then they go on the challenge and all that stuff goes away while they're on the challenge. And I'm not the only person who didn't dream and then started dreaming again on the challenge. It's not my place to say who those people are or tell their stories. In sharing my experience, I've had other people share with me that happened to them as well. It set me on an interesting path since the challenge. I spent a lot of time researching. I have degrees in psychology and counseling. I have a bachelor's of science and I have a master's in crisis intervention and trauma therapy. I understand trauma and I understand the brain. So this thing happening to me where I started dreaming again and all my symptoms went away, I'm fascinated with it. And like, how do we bottle it?
How do we make people enjoy a crisis?
I honestly think, and unfortunately, yeah, I think it's that simple. For me, my personal understanding of my experiences and my PTSD is as simple as I went into combat, bad stuff happened, my brain responded to that, like your autonomic system is in charge of all that stuff. Your fight or flight response system. That's a part of your brain that you don't have control over. It controls your heartbeat and your respiration. It controls all those things for you. And when you're getting charged by a bear, it flips all the switches and moves all the blood to the most vital organs and releases all the chemicals in your brain. It does everything physiologically to your body so that you can survive the bear attack. That part of the brain takes over. And I think that part of the brain handles trauma and PTSD. And that's what intrusive thoughts are. It's kind of like this bad thing happened to you. And so we want to constantly remind you of it so that it doesn't sneak up on you again. But when you're in combat and your brain changes so that you can survive in that kind of situation and that environment, I did one deployment. I was there almost 2 years for one single deployment. You have people that have done multiple deployments. So this has a long-term effect on the way that your brain thinks and the way that your mind works, which is great. It's not PTSD when you're in combat. But then you take me out of that scenario and then you put me in an office cubicle and I see a picture of a bear and my brain goes, oh my God, we're in danger. It's not PTSD until you're out of combat and you're in a non-combat zone where your brain no longer knows how to function outside of the danger zone. It becomes side effects. It becomes like anxiety because it doesn't know what to do because there isn't anything to respond to. That's my unprofessional personal opinion based on my own experiences. And so I think putting me back in a situation where I was alone, completely naked in a foreign environment with a giant cat trying to eat me, that was enough for that part of my brain to kick on and go, hey, we're not going to have anxiety. We're not going to have intrusive thoughts. We've got a real world danger that we need to think about. And it kicked on that whole part of my brain. And a happy accident, the dreams started coming back. So some of the anxiety and stuff is still there, but nothing is as bad as it was before the challenge. And I'm having happy dreams and I didn't die. So all in all, it worked out.
A very good explanation. As we were just talking about beforehand, I think we could probably spend a whole hour talking about the comfort crisis that modern civilization possibly forces upon us as humans. Maybe we shouldn't even get into it tonight because that would take forever, I think. But I really think you touched on it a little bit.
I can give you a quick bullet point. Okay, I'll keep it short and sweet. So I just mentioned since the challenge, I'm reading all these different books, looking for some correlation or something that acknowledges my experience where I have PTSD. I went into this survival challenge where it was a legitimate survival challenge. Not only was there not any mocha frappuccinos off camera, I was alone after my partner left. The crew, they all leave and there's just GoPros set up. They have these automatic cameras that are just pointed at your camp and then they go home. So had I been attacked by a mountain lion, I would have just been dead. There was no one there. There was no one to call. There's no help. You're on your own. And I was on my own. And that scenario had a profound effect on me, my brain. So I started reading books. Somewhere there has to be something to this because I found out I'm not the only one. The last book that I just finished is called Comfort Crisis. And the basic thesis statement of the book is that our bodies are not designed for the level of comfort of the lifestyle that we live. Something as simple as sitting in my office chair, nice, comfy, cushioned office chair in my office right now. And my body was not designed to sit in this chair. Sitting in this chair actually weakens my core, my physical core, because I'm not using the muscles that I'm supposed to be using. Our ancestors didn't sit in these chairs. They were on the ground, very much like naked and afraid. In that scenario, in that challenge, during the challenge, you try to get as comfortable as you can. You don't have chairs, so you sit on the ground. When you're sitting on the ground, even sitting in the squat position, that's one of the most comfortable positions I could be in, was the squat position. But even with that, you're using different muscle groups. We don't sit like that anymore, so we don't use those muscles anymore, and it weakens us. And something as simple as the shoes that we wear make us run incorrectly, and that does damage to our feet long-term, to our ankles and our knees and everything like that. It kind of destroys them. So we have more injuries because we're wearing shoes that are really super comfortable, but they, in the long-term, they injure us because they make us walk incorrectly than the way we're designed to walk. That's the nutshell of comfort crisis, is that our comfort is really kind of killing us. It weakens us. It makes us softer. And for me, I need to get out of this comfortable chair, and I need to go up in the woods, and I need to do something really, really hard, because for me, that's therapeutic. I need some caveman time, primitive survival skill practice, just to stay mentally, emotionally sane, but physically fit, because both of those things are very healthy for my mind and my body.
I totally agree. I believe that our modern civilization and the technology that goes along with that, as I've told you earlier, is causing us to regress as humans physically, emotionally, and mentally, and not necessarily progress as humans, not as a society, but as individual humans, regardless of what our leaders of society would say. I think at some point it's going to have possibly even dire consequences.
I would agree with that. I think the first time I mentioned the comfort crisis thing was, I think that comfort crisis and that idea that our comfortable lives are killing us, they're making us weaker. We have GPS, so we don't need to learn how to use a compass anymore. We don't need to memorize our phone numbers anymore. We just tell Siri to call somebody for us. We're not using our brains the way that they were designed to be used, and we're not using our bodies the way that they were designed to be used. We're not living life the way we evolved to live it and to survive it. Like, our lifestyle is evolving quicker, more rapidly than our bodies can, our brains can keep up with. I'll go out on a limb. I'll make the assertion that I'm convinced personally, especially for myself, that this probably has a big part to play in the popularity of survival and bushcraft and survivalism. Because before it was just camping stuff, but we're a subculture now. Bushcraft is a thing. And then the whole survival thing, I think it went from bushcraft to survival. They're not so much mutually exclusive, but they're related. And I think all of this is maybe unconscious or subconscious, but I think it's, for me anyway, it's a rejection of a rebellion against the comfort crisis that I have. I have a very comfortable life. I have a very comfortable chair. There isn't anything physically strenuous about my life. So I go rucking, which is like a backpack with a weighted plate. And I'll go do 5 to 10 miles with a 30-pound plate in the backpack because my body needs something hard to do. I need to break a sweat. I'm not getting that in the office. I think that's why there's such a popular return to nature in the idea of survivalism and bushcraft, is we need that hard thing. We need to go struggle out in the woods for a while and kind of remember our roots, I think. Reconnect with our food source.
And along with that and the healthy mindset, I debated asking you about this earlier. I debated putting it on the actual podcast, but I learned a lot from listening to your Q&A on YouTube with Amanda. And now I think I'm going to actually listen to a few more Q&As of Naked and Afraid shows, because that is the reality of the show. Anyone listening to this, you can get so much more from the Q&As of the aftermath of the show rather than the show itself. You should absolutely listen to those. But you mentioned something that I have leaned a little interest in, and is probably very controversial with several people that are listening to this, but that is Wim Hof. And you had a great explanation of Wim Hof's techniques, and the way you explained it has actually even made me want to look into it even further.
I will start off by making the assertion that it is a valid survival skill. The way that it happened for me was that somebody posted on a group that I was in on social media and said, hey, I keep reading about how cold exposure, like cold water exposure, like ice baths and cold showers, is supposed to be really healthy for you. Can anybody speak from experience, not the armchair? Yeah, I haven't had a hot shower in 3 years, and I swear by it. I feel healthier. It's awesome. I don't have the words for it other than I've been doing it solid for 3 years, and I'll never go back to hot water on purpose because it makes me feel great. So somebody else was like, oh, are you doing the WHM ? And I was like, I don't know what that is. And they said the Wim Hof method. And I was like, I still don't know what that is. So they sent a link to a YouTube video, and I went down the rabbit hole. So that's how I found it. And what it is simply a breathing technique. In the simplest sense, there's a breathing technique. And then in combination with cold exposure. And what I mean by that is a cold shower without any hot water. Or getting in, having it at whatever temperature you want, and very slowly tapering off the hot water and getting yourself down to a cold. And just being in cold water for as long as you can take. And then in time, slowly just tapering and training yourself to expose yourself to the cold water to a point where eventually you don't need hot water. What Wim Hof did was, short and sweet of his story is, he discovered, in his words, he didn't invent it, he discovered it. It's like a body biohack, where there's a breathing technique where you take 30 deep breaths, you deep in a full breath, and then you breathe out maybe 70% of that. And you do that about 30 times. So 30 deep breaths. And on the very last breath, you breathe out, you exhale, but then you just stop. You don't breathe in. So if I say, how long can you hold your breath? We all take a deep breath and we hold it. Well, that turns into carbon dioxide in your lungs and it makes it harder for you to hold it longer. So if you do the 30 breaths, breathe out and hold with your lungs empty, you can hold longer. What that does is those 30 breaths will hyperoxygenate your body. So you get all this oxygen in your body really super fast, and then you just stop breathing. That autonomic system that I mentioned that prepares you for you get attacked by a bear, that system gets activated without trigger. That system wakes up and you get that system, that part of your brain's attention, without actually triggering any kind of response like, oh shit, we're going to get attacked by a bear. Shut down all these systems and turn on the emergency response system, because your brain starts going, hey, why aren't you breathing? But you have all the oxygen that you need in your body to last about a minute and a half to 2 minutes for the first timer. You can last for a minute and a half to 2 minutes your first time. If you do it well, if you do the breath properly, all you're doing is holding your breath, but it activates that part of your brain that goes, hey, you're not breathing. So it starts checking around, and your nervous system goes through your whole body and along your bone. And what'll happen for me is different parts of my arm or my leg or my calf will twitch. And that's the autonomic system doing a nervous system check, which actually it resets that system. So when you're stressed out and you have anxiety, that's that PTSD part of the brain, the autonomic system. And when you do this breathing system, this breathing technique, it activates that part of the brain without doing a negative emergency trigger and kind of resets your stress system. It's like a breathing technique to calm you down if you're stressed out, but it also raises your immune system. You do 3 cycles and it will significantly increase your immune system. And then if you do this breathing technique and then expose yourself to cold water, it conditions your body to, when you get cold, that autonomic system will go, oh, you're cold. Well, let's raise our body temperature. Because you don't have control over that, but your autonomic system does. So this guy has broken world record for how long he can hold his breath for his cold exposure. Scientists studied him to prove that he was fake, and it turns out that now there's scientific data that proves that he can actually do it. And they said, oh, it's just you. You're an anomaly. He said, no, I can teach this to anybody. And they said, okay, we'll pick some people. And he said, no, you pick the people and give me a week with them. And then he trained them in the technique. And then guess what? They followed him and they climbed up that mountain in the snow and they're swim trunk. It's a biological model. I was already doing the cold exposure. I just like polar bear plunging. But doing the breathing technique raises your body temperature, which is a survival technique. They didn't show it, but there were multiple times when I just need fire or I need the light. I don't so much need the heat, because I just do the breathing technique to regulate my body temperature and I'm good. I just need enough light to keep the big cat away from me. Using this technique to keep yourself warm and keep your circulation going and keep your immune system high, this is a valid survival skill. But at the same time, it has all these other medical benefits. It's good for your stress level. If you combine that with the cold exposure to taking cold showers, it conditions your body. Your autonomic system will go, oh, it's cold outside. Let's just burn the engine a little hotter, which actually burns a couple of calories too. We'll talk all night about the cult of Wim Hof. But at the end of the day, you can watch a couple of YouTube videos. You don't have to buy anything. Watch a couple of the YouTube videos. The guy's entertaining. At the very least, he's very entertaining. And breathing is free, so you don't really have anything to lose.
Great pitch, actually. I'm going to do this probably all week now. 2 more things that have to be mentioned while you're still here. 1, you broke your toe on the show. No one knows this.
I mentioned it on the Q&A, and it comes up a lot. I had logged over 30 miles up in the Sequoia National Forest during this last summer, June, July, in triple digits, barefoot up in the Sequoia National Forest. That whole couple of months, I logged over 30 miles. Barefoot up and hiking with a backpack up in the woods. And I have all these people going, have you seen that show Naked and Afraid? I'm like, I can't tell you that I'm going to be on it. So I did all this work on my feet, way before I knew Naked and Afraid existed, I just keep my chanclas, my sandals, in my truck. I work at home, so I don't put on shoes unless I have to. I did all this stuff to get ready for the show, and then it got there, and none of it mattered. It sucked. It was like walking on hot glass the entire time. It was like coral. It was like a coral reef. And between the coral reef, the sharpness of the rocks, and then the temperature of those rocks and the sun, it was horrible. But I broke a toe. I broke a pinky toe, which you would think, oh, it's just the smallest toe. It was not going to hurt that much. I broke plenty of toes in martial arts as a kid. That was the first time breaking a pinky toe, and it was more painful than any of the other toes I've ever broken. And I don't show it on the show. So anytime on my episode that you see me with two sticks, I broke my toe. But then I also re-injured that toe three times. I injured it, I broke it, and then I splinted it with some plant fiber. I basically used some plant fiber, and I tied it to the toe next to it. And I hit it with some mud and some dirt because I didn't want to get tapped out for something stupid. So I tried to hide that from the crew. But when you see me making all those faces and I'm limping and everything, yeah, the ground is already hot. It's already sharp rocks. It's already sucky. Like, I didn't break my toe on day one. So all the pain I was in on day one, that was just, it just sucked to walk there. Later on, by the time I have a stick, the reason that I have a stick is because I broke my toe and then I re-injured it. And so towards the end of the episode, me and my partner, Elaine, we're lounging. I'm all laid out underneath the tree and we're talking about tattoos or something. And you can see the soles of my feet. And if you look, you'll see plant fibers tied between my toes. And that's really the only way that you can tell. And even that, you wouldn't know what it. Oh, he's got some root around his toe. I had broken that toe three times. I didn't break it three times, but every time it started to heal, I messed it up. The third time on the extraction, I caught it on a rock, and it was sticking out 90 degrees away from my foot. That was one of the more sucky things. I gouged my head, so I had a face covered in blood. The night before my migration to meet my second partner, Amanda, I had dug up a yucca and ate a root. And I boiled it. So I'm just going to town on this thing. But I had pulled a branch down out of a tree for firewood. And I got right underneath it and pulled it straight down. And it came down across the top of my head. And I got a good gash on my head. It was just pouring blood. All I can think of is this mountain lion's going to come eat me now. And but I'm like, I'm going to eat this root before the mountain lion comes and eats me. I think that was the first time I broke my toe, too. There's a lot of blood and broken toes, and none of that stuff made the cut. I got teased by some of my immediate peers because they see me running around barefoot all the time, and they're like, they made you look like such a sissy. I'm all, dude, I had a broken toe. And they're like, oh, the pinky toe, like that whole side of your foot hurt. So it wasn't even the ground or the heat, but just that toe, the pressure of putting that foot, you know, standing on that foot was painful too, more than once. That was a challenging aspect that nobody knows about.
That's why I thought it had to be mentioned. And then the last thing that has to be mentioned, just because, your Home Depot billhook.
Oh, my billhook. Yeah. Oh, man, I love that thing. I swear by it. I want to be the spokesperson for Fiskars. I was at Walmart 17 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. And I'm in the garden section, and I got a new water hose and stuff. And I'm just standing in line in the garden section. I look over and I see that billhook. Man, that's a good looking blade right there. It was just very appealing. I pick it up and I like the weight and everything. And it was like $12 back then. It was literally a random impulse buy. And that was it. It's been a lifelong love affair. We've been together for 15, 16 years now. The handle's wrapped with athletic grip tape. For the show, I took it in and I had them modify the tip. It curves like a candy cane and it's blunt. And I had them sharpen the back side of that curve into like a raptor talon. So that way I could use the back side of the outside of the blade if I needed to push down on a snake head. I was anticipating a lot of snakes and I've used that thing to pin a snake head down. But I was like, you know, if I would have sharpened the back of that curve, I could have used it and just pushed straight down and used my palm and pommeled the bottom of the end of the handle and pushed that blade, if it was sharpened into a blade on the back, straight through a snake or pretty much anything. So I had it modified and had the back end of the curve sharpened. And it came in handy. I made a special sheath for it. I took a big long piece of leather, folded it in half, and then braided up so that it slides in there. It's nice and wide. And I was thinking, I wonder if I can get away with this. But if things get rough enough, I can take the braid out. I can unfold that piece of leather, I can cut it into two pieces and I can make and use the braid as a thong and I can make a pair of sandals. And I was out on the challenge, and I was like, hey, can I just go ahead and make sandals out of these? And I explained to him this was my plan. They were like, yeah, no, that's cheating. We're impressed that you smuggled that in, but that's cheating. But I made the argument in a real-world scenario that I would have done it already. The billhook has been my default. I got a Tom Brown tracker, and I took that up on purpose up in the Sequoias to try it out. But I ended up, when I actually got up there, I didn't end up using the Tom Brown. Like, it's fun. It's a great knife, but my default has, for the last 16 years, has been that billhook. I don't think it gets enough credit. And then I did the research on it, and it turns out that thing's been around for a couple hundred years. It's not a new idea. It's a revamp of a really old tool/weapon. Again, I want to come out with like my own Wish Dr. Joe's billhook or something like that. I don't know, but I'm a big billhook fan.
You should definitely do that. Wish Dr. Joe's billhook.
They teach you some things about the show, because there's the entertainment value of the show. And one of the things that they said is, when we're gone, we have these cameras set up, but you need to be aware of where they are and where they're not. Because if you're doing stuff in an area where the cameras aren't set up and we're gone, basically, if it didn't happen on camera, it didn't happen. And there's so many cool things. My director was like, there are so many amazing things that no one will ever know because it wasn't caught on camera. They're like, don't be shy. Record everything, because you never know what could get captured or what's going to get missed. And one of the things that they grumbled about that I told them about, but they didn't get it on camera, was on the show, I have the yucca stalk, and I usually have two of them. And I am a big fan of actual bird nests, and I'm pretty good at making the bushcraft bird nest, but the actual bird nest works better. And most of the birds make their nests in the yucca plants because, I mean, it's a fortress of thorns. And it's pretty hard for any predators to get in there to get to it. So they usually make their nests right up against the base of the stalk, down behind the blades of the plant, because the Spanish sword yucca is just horrible with the blades on the side of the leaf. I knew this because we have it where I live. I knew where to look to get the bird nests. We used those up pretty quickly. And my partner Amanda was like, hey, I found another bird's nest, but it's up in the tree. So my point is that I whittled up the end of one of my stabs, and I jammed that up into, because the handle's hollow, and it doesn't feel hollow, but just because of the way that thing is made, it's designed and it's made so well that you forget that the handle is actually hollow. But I crammed the stick up there into the handle and used it. Like I said, it used to be a weapon. They used to use it as a pole weapon, like a pole spear, where you would defend against heavy cavalry. They had those on long poles in Europe and a bunch of other countries during medieval times. That was like a war weapon. But I have it on this long staff, and I hacked off the branch of the tree that was probably, I don't know, 8 feet above me with this thing, and then got like the very last bird's nest. And then after the fact, they were like, what'd you do? What did we miss? And I was like, oh, I cut that branch down off that tree. And they're like, how did you do that? And I was like, oh, I stuck this to the bottom of my billhook. And they're like, did you record it? And I'm like, no. And they're like, that's one of those things that, you know, they're like, that would have been great. And I don't know if it would have made the cut, but it's an interesting aspect of that particular billhook. It gives you more options. Like, you can take a broomstick in there and give yourself some reach.
It's obviously a very versatile tool. And yeah. I'm impressed with that explanation. I'm always looking for something better, or we all should be looking for something better, and versatility adds a whole new universe to any tool. This has been fantastic, Joe. I don't see how we could cover anything else in one episode of this podcast. I think one day I'm going to have to call you back for sure, because we're going to have to talk again. But this has been fantastic. I greatly appreciated you coming on the show. I had a feeling you were going to be a great guest and a passionate guest talking about what you had to say. So, and you did not disappoint in that way.
Oh, good. I'm glad I didn't disappoint you. And I really enjoyed this. I had a blast. And yeah, anytime. Like I said, I'm stuck at work. I live there. And so I'm just sitting here at home. That's my job. So like, I got nothing else to like, call me. Hey. I'm more than happy to come back on here and talk to you guys zero off anytime.
Hey, we're going to do it again, because I know there's some more things you want to say, and there's some more things I want to hear, not just about the show, but I think you have a lot to say that I still want to hear. So be ready for a call pretty soon.
Yeah, anytime, man. I appreciate it. I had a blast. Thank you for having me on.
Friends, once again, that was Joseph Nichter, and I do hope you enjoyed and appreciated our discourse on this podcast. I know Joel will return to the Dirt Walker Outdoors podcast at some point in the near future. Please stay tuned and follow Dirt Walker Outdoors and Survival and the Dirt Walker Outdoors podcast for more interesting interviews with unique and adventurous people from the survival and outdoor community. Until next time, Dirt Walker, off trail.